with what she would have sworn was curiosity, then looked into her eyes and cocked its head to one side. "This is it," she thought. "This is how I go out. And I'm not going to know what did it or why." Dying she could handle. Dying without any answers seemed terribly cruel. The creature took one step toward her, then stopped and shuddered. A new pair of limbs burst out of its midsection and writhed in the air like tentacles. Its head, already grotesque, seemed to swell up. The blue eyes flashed as bright as the lights in the domes. And then it exploded in a ball of fire that hurled her away across the ice and slammed her into a low ridge, hard enough for the impact-absorbing gel in her suit to go rigid, freezing her in place. She lay on her back, fading toward unconsciousness. The night sky above her began to flash with light. The ships in orbit, shooting each other. "Cease fire," she thought, pressing it out into the blackness. They were retreating. Cease fire. Her radio was still out, her suit dead. She couldn't tell anyone that the UN Marines hadn't been attacking, or that something else had. Chapter 2. Holden. The coffee maker was broken again. Again. Jim Holden clicked the red brew button in and out several more times, knowing it wouldn't matter, but helpless to stop himself. The massive and gleaming coffee maker, designed to brew enough to keep a Martian naval crew happy, refused to make a single cup. Or even a noise. It wasn't just refusing to brew, it was refusing to try. Holden closed his eyes against the caffeine headache that threatened his temples and hit the button on the nearest wall panel to open the shipwide comm. "Amos," he said. The comm wasn't working. Feeling increasingly ridiculous, he pushed the button for the 1MC channel several more times. Nothing. He opened his eyes and saw that all the lights on the panel were out. Then he turned around and saw that the lights on the refrigerator and the ovens were out. It wasn't just the coffee maker. The entire galley was in open revolt. Holden looked at the ship name, Rocinante, newly stenciled onto the galley wall, and said, "Baby, why do you hurt me when I love you so much?" He pulled out his hand terminal and called Naomi. After several moments, she finally answered. Hello? "The galley doesn't work. Where's Amos?" A pause. "You called me from the galley? While we are on the same ship? The wall panel just one step too far away?" "The wall panel in the galley doesn't work either. When I said the galley doesn't work, it wasn't clever hyperbole. It literally means that not one thing in the galley works. I called you because you carry your terminal and Amos almost never does, and also because he never tells me what he's working on, but he always tells you. So where is Amos?" Naomi laughed. It was a lovely sound, and it never failed to put a smile on Holden's face. "He told me he was going to be doing some rewiring." "Do you have power up there? Are we hurtling out of control and you guys were trying to figure out how to break the news to me?" Holden could hear tapping from Naomi's end. She hummed to herself as she worked. "Nope," she said. "Only area without power seems to be the galley. Also, Alex says we're less than an hour from fighting with space pirates. Want to come up to ops and fight pirates?" "I can't fight pirates without coffee. I'm going to find Amos," Holden said, then hung up and put his terminal back in his pocket. Holden moved to the ladder that ran down the keel of the ship and called up the lift. The fleeing pirate ship could only sustain about 1G for extended flight, so Holden's pilot, Alex Kamal, had them flying at 1.3G to intercept. Anything over 1G made the ladder dangerous to use. A few seconds later, The deck hatch clanged open and the lift whined to a stop at his feet. He stepped on and tapped the button for the engineering deck. The lift began its slow crawl down the shaft, deck hatches opening at its approach, then slamming shut once he had passed. Amos Burton was in the machine shop, one deck above engineering. He had a complex-looking device half disassembled on the workbench in front of him, and was working on it with a solder gun. He wore a gray jumpsuit, several sizes too small for him, which strained to contain his broad shoulders when he moved. The old ship name, Tachi, still embroidered on the back. Holden stopped the lift and said, "Amos, the galley doesn't work." Amos waved one thick arm in an impatient gesture without stopping his work. Holden waited. After another couple seconds of soldering, Amos finally put down the tool and turned around. "Yep, it doesn't work because I got this little fucker yanked out of it," he said, pointing at the device he'd been soldering. "Can you put it back?" "Nope, at least not yet. Not done working on it." Holden sighed. "Is it important that we disable the galley to fix this thing just before confronting a bloodthirsty band of space pirates? Because my head is really starting to ache and I'd love to get a cup of coffee before, you know, doing battle." "Yep, it was important," Amos said. "Should I explain why, or you want to take my word for it?" Holden nodded. While he didn't miss much about his days in the Earth Navy, he did find that he occasionally got nostalgic for the absolute respect for the chain of command. On the Rocinante, the title captain was much more nebulously defined. Rewiring things was Amos's job, and he would resist the idea that he had to inform Holden any time he was doing it. Holden let it drop. "Okay," he said, "but I wish you'd warned me ahead of time. I'm going to be cranky without my coffee." Amos grinned at him and pushed his cap back on his mostly bald head. "Shit, Cap, I can cover you on that," he said, then reached back and grabbed a massive metal thermos off the bench. "I made some emergency supplies before I shut the galley down." "Amos, I apologize for all the mean things I was thinking about you just now." Amos waved it off and turned back to his work. "Take it. I already had a cup." Holden climbed back onto the lift and rode it up to the operations deck, the thermos clutched in both hands like a life preserver. Naomi was seated at the sensor and communications panel, tracking their progress in pursuit of the fleeing pirates. Holden could see at a glance that they were much closer than the last estimate he'd received. He strapped himself into the combat operations couch. He opened a nearby cabinet and, guessing they might be at low G or in free fall in the near future, pulled out a drinking bulb for his coffee. As he filled it from the thermos's nipple, he said, "We're closing awful fast, what's up?" "Pirate ship has slowed down quite a bit from its initial 1G acceleration. They dropped to half a G for a couple of minutes, then stopped accelerating altogether a minute ago. The computer tracked some fluctuations in drive output just before they slowed, so I think we chased them too hard."
"They broke their ship?"
"They broke their ship." Holden took a long drink out of the bulb, scalding his tongue in the process and not caring.
"How long to intercept now?"
5 minutes tops. Alex was waiting to do the final D-cell burn until you were up here and belted in. Holden tapped the comm panel's 1MC button and said,
"Amos, buckle up. 5 minutes to bad guys."
Then he switched to the cockpit channel and said,
"Alex, what's the word?"
"I do believe they broke their ship,"
Alex replied in his Martian Mariner Valley drawl.
"That seems to be the consensus," Holden said.
"Makes running away a bit harder."
The Mariner Valley had originally been settled by Chinese East Indians and Texans. Alex had the dark complexion and jet-black hair of an East Indian. Coming as he did from Earth, Holden always found it strangely disconcerting when an exaggerated Texas drawl came from someone his brain said should be speaking with Punjabi accents.
"And it makes our day easier," Holden replied, warming up the combat ops panel. Bring us to a relative stop at 10,000 clicks. I'm going to paint them with the targeting laser and turn on the point defense cannons. Open the outer doors to the tubes, too. No reason not to look as threatening as possible.
Roger that, boss, Alex replied.
Naomi swiveled in her chair and gave Holden a grin. Fighting space pirates, very romantic. Holden couldn't help smiling back. Even wearing a Martian naval officer's jumpsuit that was 3 sizes too short and 5 sizes too big around for her long and thin belter frame, she looked beautiful to him. Her long and curly black hair was pulled into an unruly tail behind her head. Her features were a striking mix of Asian, South American, and African that was unusual even in the melting pot of the belt. He glanced at his brown-haired Montana farm boy reflection in a darkened panel and felt very generic by comparison.
You know how much I like anything that gets you to say the word romantic, he said, but I'm afraid I lack your enthusiasm. We started out saving the solar system from a horrific alien menace. Now this?
Holden had only known one cop well, and him briefly. During the massive and unpleasant series of clusterfucks that now went under the shorthand, the Eros incident, Holden had teamed up for a time with a thin, gray, broken man called Miller. By the time they'd met, Miller had already walked away from his official job to obsessively follow a missing persons case. They'd never precisely been friends, but they'd managed to stop the human race from being wiped out by a corporation's self-induced sociopathy and a recovered alien weapon that everyone in human history had mistaken for a moon of Saturn. By that standard, at least, the partnership had been a success. Holden had been a naval officer for 6 years. He'd seen people die, but only from the vantage of a radar screen. On Eros, he'd seen thousands of people die, up close and in horrific ways. He'd killed a couple of them himself. The radiation dose he'd received there meant he had to take constant medications to stop the cancer that kept blooming in his tissues. He'd still gotten off lighter than Miller. Because of Miller, the alien infection had landed on Venus instead of Earth. But that hadn't killed it. Whatever the aliens' hijacked, confused programming was, it was still going on under that planet's thick cloud cover, and no one had so far been able to offer any scientific conclusions more compelling than, weird. Saving humanity had cost the old, tired belter detective his life. Saving humanity had turned Holden into an employee of the Outer Planets Alliance, tracking down pirates. Even on the bad days, he had to think he'd gotten the better end of that deal.
30 seconds to intercept, Alex said.
Holden pulled his mind back to the present and called down to engineering.
You all strapped in down there, Amos?
Roger, Cap, ready to go.
Try not to get my girl all shot up.
No one's shooting anyone today, Holden said after he shut the comlink off.
Naomi heard him and raised an eyebrow in question.
Naomi, give me comms. I want to call our friends out there.
A second later, the comm controls appeared on his panel. He aimed a tight beam at the pirate ship and waited for the link light to go green. When it did, he said,
Undesignated light freighter, this is Captain James Holden of the Outer Planets Alliance missile frigate Rocinante. Please respond.
His headset was silent except for the faint static of background radiation.
Look, guys, let's not play games. I know you know who I am. I also know that 5 days ago you attacked the food freighter Somnambulist, disabled its engines, and stole 6,000 kilos of protein and all of their air, which is pretty much all I need to know about you.
More staticky silence.
So, here's the deal. I'm tired of following you, and I'm not going to let you stall me while you fix your broken ship and then lead me on another merry chase.
If you don't signal your full and complete surrender in the next 60 seconds, I am going to fire a pair of torpedoes with high-yield plasma warheads and melt your ship into glowing slag. Then I'm going to fly back home and sleep really well tonight. The static was finally broken by a boy who sounded way too young to have already decided on a life of piracy.
You can't do that. The OPA isn't a real government. You can't legally do shit to me, so back the fuck off, the voice said,
sounding like it was on the verge of a pubescent squeak the entire time.
Seriously? That's the best you've got? Holden replied.
Look, forget the debate about legality and what constitutes actual governmental authority for a minute. Look at the LADAR returns you're getting from my ship. While you are a cobbled-together light freighter that someone welded a homemade Gauss cannon onto, I'm in a state-of-the-art Martian torpedo bomber with enough firepower to slag a small moon. The voice on the other end didn't reply.
Guys, even if you don't recognize me as the appropriate legal authority, can we at least agree that I can blow you up anytime I want to?
The comm remained silent. Holden sighed and rubbed the bridge of his nose. In spite of the caffeine, his headache was refusing to go away. Leaving the channel open to the pirate ship, he opened another channel to the cockpit.
Alex, put a short burst from the forward point defense cannons through that freighter. Aim for midships.
Wait! Yelled the kid on the other ship. We surrender! Jesus Christ!
Holden stretched out in the zero-G, enjoying it after the days of acceleration, and grinned to himself. No one gets shot today, indeed.
Naomi, tell our new friends how to give remote control of their ship to you, and let's take them back to Tycho Station for the OPA tribunals to figure out. Alex, once they have their engines back up, plot us a return trip at a nice comfortable half-G. I'll be down in sick bay trying to find aspirin.
Holden unbuckled his crash couch harness and pushed off to the deck ladder. Along the way, his hand terminal started beeping. It was Fred Johnson, the nominal leader of the OPA and their personal patron on the Tycho Corporation's manufacturing station, which was also now doubling as the de facto OPA headquarters.
Yo, Fred. Caught our naughty pirates. Bringing them back for trial.
Fred's large, dark face crinkled into a grin.
That's a switch. Got tired of blowing them up?
Nope, just finally found someone who believed me when I said I would.
Fred's grin turned into a frown.
Listen, Jim. That's not why I called. I need you back at Tycho on the double.
Something's happening on Ganymede. Chapter 3. Prax. Praxidiki Mung stood in the doorway of the staging barn, looking out at the fields of softly waving leaves so utterly green they were almost black, and panicked. The dome arched above him, darker than it should have been. Power to the grow lights had been cut, and the mirrors... he couldn't think about the mirrors. The flickers of fighting ships looked like glitches on a cheap screen, colors and movements that shouldn't have been there. The sign that something was very wrong. He licked his lips. There had to be a way. There had to be some way to save them.
Prax, Doris said. We have to go, now.
The cutting edge of low-resource agricultural botany, the glycine quinan, a type of soybean so heavily modified it was an entirely new species, represented the last 8 years of his life. They were the reason his parents still hadn't seen their only granddaughter in the flesh. They, and a few other things, had ended his marriage. He could see the 8 subtly different strains of engineered chloroplasts in the fields, each one trying to spin out the most protein per photon. His hands were trembling. He was going to vomit.
We have maybe 5 more minutes to impact, Doris said. We have to evacuate.
I don't see it, Prax said.
It's coming fast enough. By the time you see it, you won't see it. Everyone else is already gone. We're the last ones. Now get in the lift.
The great orbital mirrors had always been his allies, shining down on his fields like 100 pale suns. He couldn't believe that they'd betray him. It was an insane thought. The mirror plummeting toward the surface of Ganymede, toward his greenhouse, his soybeans, his life's work, hadn't chosen anything. It was a victim of cause and effect, the same as everything else. "I'm about to leave," Doris said. "If you're here in 4 minutes, you'll die." "Wait," Prax said. He ran out into the dome. At the edge of the nearest field, he fell to his knees and dug into the rich black soil. The smell of it was like a good patchouli. He pushed his fingers in as deep as he could, cupping a root ball. The small, fragile plant came up in his hands. Doris was in the industrial lift, ready to descend into the caves and tunnels of the station. Prax sprinted for her. With the plant to save, the dome suddenly felt horribly dangerous. He threw himself through the door, and Doris pressed the control display. The wide metal room of the lift lurched, shifted, and began its descent. Normally, it would have carried heavy equipment, the tiller, the tractor, the tons of humus taken from the station recycling processors. Now it was only the three of them. Prax sitting cross-legged on the floor, the soybean seedling nodding in his lap, Doris chewing her lower lip and watching her hand terminal. The lift felt too big. "The mirror could miss," Prax said. "It could, but it's 1,300 tons of glass and metal. The shockwave will be fairly large." "The dome might hold." "No," she said, and Prax stopped talking to her. The cart hummed and clanked, falling deeper under the surface ice, sliding into the network of tunnels that made up the bulk of the station. The air smelled like heating elements and industrial lubricant. Even now, he couldn't believe they'd done it. He couldn't believe the military bastards had actually started shooting each other. No one anywhere could really be that short-sighted, except that it seemed they could. In the months since the Earth-Mars alliance had shattered, he'd gone from constant and gnawing fear to cautious hope to complacency. Every day that the United Nations and the Martians hadn't started something had been another bit of evidence that they wouldn't. He'd let himself think that everything was more stable than it looked. Even if things got bad and there was a shooting war, it wouldn't be here. Ganymede was where the food came from. With its magnetosphere, it was the safest place for pregnant women to gestate, claiming the lowest incidence of birth defects and stillbirth in the outer planets. It was the center of everything that made human expansion into the solar system possible. Their work was as precious as it was fragile, and the people in charge would never let the war come here. Doris said something obscene. Prax looked up at her. She ran a hand through her thin, white hair, turned and spat. "Lost connectivity," she said, holding up the hand terminal. "Whole network's locked down." "By who?" "Station security, United Nations, Mars, how would I know?" "But if they..." The concussion was like a giant fist coming down on the cart's roof. The emergency brakes kicked in with a bone-shaking clang. The lights went out, darkness swallowing them for two hummingbird-fast heartbeats. 4 battery-powered emergency LEDs popped on, then off again, as the cart's power came back. The critical failure diagnostic started to run. Motors humming, lifts clicking, the tracking interface spooling through checksums like an athlete stretching before a run. Prax stood up and walked to the control panel. The shaft sensors reported minimal atmospheric pressure and falling. He felt a shudder as containment doors closed somewhere above them and the exterior pressure started to rise. The air in the shaft had been blown out into space before the emergency systems could lock down. His dome was compromised. His dome was gone. He put his hand to his mouth.
not realizing he was smearing soil across his chin until he'd already done it. Part of his mind was skittering over the things that needed to be done to save the project. Contact his project manager at RMD Southern, refile the supplemental grant applications, get the data backups to rebuild the viral insertion samples, while another part had gone still and eerily calm. The sense of being two men, one bent on desperate measures, the other already in the numb of mourning, felt like the last weeks of his marriage. Doris turned to him, a weary amusement plucking at her wide lips. She put out her hand. "It was a pleasure working with you, Dr. Meng." The cart shuddered as the emergency brakes retracted. Another impact came from much farther off. A mirror or a ship falling. Soldiers shelling each other on the surface. Maybe even fighting deeper in the station. There was no way to know. He shook her hand. "Dr. Bourne," he said, "it has been an honor." They took a long, silent moment at the graveside of their previous lives. Doris sighed. "All right," she said, "let's get the hell out of here." May's daycare was deep in the body of the moon, but the tube station was only a few hundred yards from the cart's loading dock, and the express trip down to her was no more than 10 minutes, or would have been if they were running. In 3 decades of living on Ganymede, Prax had never even noticed that the tube stations had security doors. The 4 soldiers standing in front of the closed station wore thick-plated armor, painted in shifting camouflage lines the same shades of beige and steel as the corridor. They carried intimidatingly large assault rifles and scowled at the crowd of 12 or more pressing in around them. "I am on the transportation board," a tall, thin, dark-skinned woman was saying, punctuating each word by tapping her finger on 1 soldier's chest plate. "If you don't let us past, then you're in trouble. Serious trouble." "How long is it going to be down?" a man asked. "I need to get home. How long is it going to be down?" "Ladies and gentlemen," the soldier on the left shouted. She had a powerful voice. It cut through the rumble and murmur of the crowd like a teacher speaking to restless schoolchildren. "This settlement is in security lockdown. Until the military action is resolved, there is no movement between levels except by official personnel." "Whose side are you on?" someone shouted. "Are you Martians? Whose side are you on?" "In the meantime," the soldier went on, ignoring the question, "we're going to ask you all to be patient. As soon as it's safe to travel, the tube system will be opened. Until that time, we're going to ask you to remain calm for your own safety." Prax didn't know he was going to speak until he heard his own voice. He sounded whiny. "My daughter's in the 8th level. Her school's down there." "Every level is in lockdown, sir," the soldier said. "She'll be just fine. You just have to be patient." The dark-skinned woman from the transportation board crossed her arms. Prax saw 2 men abandon the press, walking back down the narrow, dirty hall, talking to each other. In the old tunnels this far up, the air smelled of recyclers, plastic and heat and artificial scents, and now also of fear. "Ladies and gentlemen," the soldier shouted, "for your own safety, you need to remain calm and stay where you are until the military situation has been resolved." "What exactly is the military situation?" a woman at Prax's elbow said, her voice making the words a demand. "It's rapidly evolving," the soldier said. Prax thought there was a dangerous buzz in her voice. She was as scared as anyone. Only she had a gun. So this wasn't going to work. He had to find something else. His 1 remaining glycine kinon still in his hand, Prax walked away from the tube station. He'd been 8 years old when his father had transferred from the high population centers of Europa to help build a research lab on Ganymede. The construction had taken 10 years, during which Prax had gone through a rocky adolescence. When his parents had packed up to move the family to a new contract on an asteroid in eccentric orbit near Neptune, Prax had stayed behind. He'd gotten a botany internship, thinking that he could use it to grow illicit, untaxed marijuana, only to discover that every third botany intern had come in with the same plan. The 4 years he'd spent trying to find a forgotten closet or an abandoned tunnel that wasn't already occupied by an illegal hydroponics experiment left him with a good sense of the tunnel architecture. He walked through the old, narrow hallways of the first-generation construction. Men and women sat along the walls or in the bars and restaurants, their faces blank or angry or frightened. The display screens were set on old entertainment loops of music or theater or abstract art instead of the usual news feeds. No hand terminals chimed with incoming messages. By the central air ducts, he found what he'd been looking for. The maintenance transport always had a few old electric scooters lying around. No one used them anymore. Because Prax was a senior researcher, his hand terminal would let him through the rusting chain-link fence. He found one scooter with a sidecar and half a charge still in the batteries. It had been 7 years since he'd been on a scooter. He put the glycine kenon in the sidecar, ran through the diagnostic sequence, and wheeled himself out to the hall. The first three ramps had soldiers just like the ones he'd seen at the tube station. Prax didn't bother stopping. At the fourth, a supply tunnel that led from the surface warehouses down toward the reactors, there was nobody. He paused, the scooter silent beneath him. There was a bright acid smell in the air that he couldn't quite place. Slowly, other details registered. The scorch marks at the wall panel. A smear of something dark along the floor. He heard a distant popping sound that it took three or four long breaths to recognize as gunfire. Rapidly evolving apparently meant fighting in the tunnels. The image of May's classroom, stippled with bullet holes and soaked in children's blood, popped into his mind, as vivid as something he was remembering instead of imagining. The panic he'd felt in the dome came down on him again, but 100 times worse. "She's fine," he told the plant beside him. "They wouldn't have a firefight in a daycare. They're kids there." The green-black leaves were already starting to wilt. They wouldn't have a war around children, or food supplies, or fragile agricultural domes. His hands were trembling again, but not so badly he couldn't steer. The first explosion came just as he was heading down the ramp from 7 to level 8 along the side of one of the cathedral-huge, unfinished caverns where the raw ice of the moon had been left to weep and refreeze, something between a massive green space and a work of art. There was a flash, then a concussion, and the scooter was fishtailing. The wall loomed up fast, and Prax wrenched his leg out of the way before the impact. Above him, he heard voices shouting. Combat troops would be in armor, talking through their radios. At least, he thought they would. The people screaming up there had to be just people. A second explosion gouged the cavern wall. A section of blue-white ice the size of a tractor calving off the roof and falling slowly and inexorably down to the floor, grinding into it. Prax scrambled to keep the scooter upright. His heart felt like it was trying to break out of his ribcage. On the upper edge of the curving ramp, he saw figures in armor. He didn't know if they were UN or Mars. One of them turned toward him, lifting a rifle.